This is Dolores Cannon with the Metaphysical Hour. We're back again with another guest tonight. I do want to say we've really got strange weather. Just the other day we had a record high here where it was up in 85. And yesterday it bottom dropped down and it went down to the record low last night, and we woke up this morning with snow. So talk about strange weather. Really, it's pretty, but it's really weird to see the trees budding out all covered in snow. So I don't know what's going on. Let me give out the toll-free number before I introduce my guest. We have a toll-free number that is good all over the world if anybody wants to call in. It's 877-876-5227. 877-876-5227. It's good anywhere in the world if you want to call in and talk to our guest tonight. Okay, my guest tonight is David Hatcher Childress. And people in the metaphysical world I know who he is because he's always lecturing and traveling. I consider him like the modern Indiana Jones. And I know he's been called an amateur archaeologist, but I don't see anything amateur about David at all. He travels everywhere in the world, exploring and searching for new mysteries. In that way, he's like me. I'm always looking for lost knowledge, and he does it himself by going to the places, going underwater looking for Atlantis, and I don't think there's any place he hasn't gone. I greatly admire David, and I'm really glad that he agreed to come on tonight. So you're there, aren't you, David?
Yeah, Dolores, it's good to be on your show.
Okay, because usually it's hard to get you while you're in the country.
I've just come back from Mexico, in fact, and I'm working on my new book, which is about the mystery of the Olmecs. And
that's the one with those large heads down there, the stone heads, isn't it?
That's right, that's right. Those giant stone heads. And the Olmecs are all kinds of different things. Many of the Olmecs are like these giant African-looking stone heads. They weigh 20 tons or something like that. But other Olmecs look different than that.
Well, I know they're always saying it's strange that they have an African look to the heads.
Well, that's right. And
they have an African look. Did you find anything out about that?
Well, that's right. There's not many books that have actually been written about the Olmecs. They're virtually unknown. They are thought to be, though, the oldest civilization in the Americas, which is kind of unusual. So, yeah, they're before the Mayas, certainly before the Toltecs or Aztecs or Mixtecs or other people like that. So not only are the Olmecs the oldest civilization in the Americas, and they go back at least 3,000 years, probably more than that. And but yet, you know, they rather than looking like Mayas or American Indians, they appear to be like Africans. They others, though, have mustaches. They appear to be more like Phoenicians or something like that. And in fact, other Olmecs look very Chinese. So it's kind of almost like a melting pot of all the different cultures there.
Well, this is what you do, though. You go and search out mysteries, don't you?
Well, exactly. And, I love nothing more than just going out in the jungles and finding some giant wall made out of granite, some pyramid, some giant stone statue, or scuba diving now to underwater cities and things like that. And, you know, I catalog a lot of my adventures are in.
I saw a documentary one time where it showed that you were doing the scuba diving. I think it was looking for remains of Atlantis. I don't remember where it was, but there were under city walls, underwater walls, and it showed you down there exploring that.
Well, and one of the things that I say a lot in my lectures and when I'm on TV and radio is talking about, you know, what even mainstream geologists are telling us, which is that 10,000 years ago, there were ocean levels were 300 feet lower than they are today. And really, in just like today, in the ancient world, people built cities generally where rivers come together and where also rivers meet the ocean, which is sea level, of course. So if people were building cities, civilizations, ports, and things like that 10,000 years ago, 15,000 years ago, 20,000 years ago, which I maintain in my books, then, you know, they would be building them where these oceans and river systems are meeting. And today that would be 300 feet underwater. And that's, you know, that's where you would go to find these sunken cities. Like Atlantis would be there. I'm a big promoter of that. I've just done the introduction to a new edition of James Churchward's Lost Continent of Mu, which is one of the early books about there being some kind of lost Pacific continent, Mu, Lemuria, Pan, other names like that.
Okay. Well, I do want to say, I think you, what, have you written about 40 books, or am I exaggerating or not?
Not quite that many. I have written and have been the editor of about 25 books, actually, and including the Lost Cities series.
I thought it was more because I know it has to do with lost cities and lost civilizations, and I know you're always traipsing. You said like in the jungles. One time I was talking to you and you were getting ready to leave from Mongolia, so you go where the angels fear to tread anyway. But
I do. I love to travel and I love people and like you, you know, and I know you like to travel. The more you see, and the world is so fascinating a place, and people often ask me, you know, what is your favorite place or something like that, and I don't have really an answer for that. I have many favorite places, and it's the rare place that I've been to that I didn't really like, actually, so, and there's many places I still have yet to go, by the way, so I'm traveling all the time.
You go out there where nobody else gets to go, though. Because where I go, it's usually civilization, and you go where there isn't any civilization.
Well, right. I mean, I'm I do that, of course, to a point. But I'm also, you know, staying in hotels and oftentimes in just kind of remote areas, Mongolia or Tibet. And, again, many ancient ruins, I believe, now are underwater. South America is a great place, and for adventure and lost cities, just mysteries of the past, everything from Nazca and to Machu Picchu and Tiwanaku, Lake Titicaca, lost pyramids in the jungle. It's really super down there, and I always can recommend to that young person who wants to go out and have archaeological adventures, head for South America. And in fact, everyone.
I've been to Machu.
You've been to Machu Picchu, right?
Yeah, and that was—I wouldn't have gone any further, but that was really wild enough. And if you're right, it really is fantastic. But they said, what did they say that this TV crew had been down there and their cameras fell over and they broke a piece off of that, the Monument of the Sun down there. Did you hear about that?
Yeah, the Intihuatana, the hitching post of the sun. That is right, a boom of a camera hit that and knocked a chip off the corner, and that made international news at the time. Yeah.
Now they're getting stricter about it, and they began putting up barriers. You know, they're not going to have the free run of it the way we did when we were down there. So, you know, they're afraid something else is going to get damaged.
Yeah, well, I think it's just around that important thing, which is kind of the centerpiece of Machu Picchu. Machu Picchu is the most popular of all the megalithic cities and tourist sites in South America. And it is, it's a secret city. You know, I've maintained in my books on Lost Cities, Ancient Mysteries, South America, and other books too, like Technology of the Gods and whatnot, that the Incas didn't build Machu Picchu or Cusco or Sacsayhuaman.
I believe that. And our guide told us they knew that they didn't. But, you know, that's what they always try to tell you. But they knew that was way, way older than the Incas.
That's right. And
when I was down there, though, I had trouble with altitude sickness. Did it bother you?
Yeah, that's no, I grew up in Colorado, and I've spent a lot of time in the Himalayas, even technical climbing, Mount Everest and stuff like that, as well as Tibet, and I've climbed Mount Kilimanjaro and things like that. So, yeah, I've been to high altitude a lot, so it doesn't bother me. But for most people it is, and particularly when you fly from sea level up to, say, Cusco or to La Paz in Bolivia, you're going to like 12,000, 13,000 feet almost like instantly. And that will affect anybody, really. I mean, that's one of the things about
your body. Well, Lake Titicaca. And if like that. But, yeah, we flew from Lima right up to Cusco, and that was a jolt to our system. So, you know, I would warn people if they go down there that it could happen anyway. But otherwise, a day or so, and you seem to recover anyway. But
yeah, right.
Okay. But, you know, I've gone to some of these places, but not way back in the places that you've been. But have you ever been anywhere that you felt you might have been in danger?
Oh, sure. And, I mean, I've even had to carry guns at times, and as well as pepper spray and things like that. I mean, sometimes when you move through areas in the Middle East, in Africa, in South America, and Indonesia, Papua New Guinea, certain Pacific Islands even, yeah, I mean, you're going to go oftentimes as a kind of a private army. Perhaps your guides are armed. And, you know, yeah, I mean, I'm lucky to be alive, actually. I've had people try and kill me, and I write about that in my books, my Lost Cities books and stuff, so.
Okay, but then you don't go in there by yourself. You do have people go with you.
Yeah, that's right, that's right.
If you go alone, you probably wouldn't survive anyway.
Yeah, I mean, and sometimes it would be maybe okay to go in by yourself, but I don't do that. I always go with guides, other members of the World Explorers Club. We have a magazine, too, called World Explorer. We have web pages at wexclub.com. Those are our, maybe there's a link from your web pages to our World Explorers Club pages. But that's what our magazine's all about, too, is going to remote areas, new archaeological discoveries, a lot of earth mysteries. Also, you know, I've always been interested in cryptozoology as well, lake monsters and Bigfoot and Yeti, and I've actually been on Yeti expeditions in the Himalayas and things like that. So,
thinking there's probably not anything I can mention that you haven't explored anyway.
Well, I'm trying to go to the moon, actually. That would be fun. I did, one of my books is called Extraterrestrial Archaeology, where in that book we go to, you know, to the moon and Mars and other planets looking for pyramids and structures. In my book on Atlantis and the power system of the gods, I combine my interest in Tesla and anti-gravity and free energy, other ancient technologies, with the whole obelisk system and how obelisks are, in my mind, these Atlantean-type monolithic crystal towers. And they were basically transmitting power in the ancient world, much as Tesla had tried to do with the towers that he was building in Long Island, also in Colorado Springs.
So that's my work too. I've done a lot with Atlantis, and we have a lot of information about the crystals, but I never thought about the opalisks as being part of that. But I could see if it served like an antenna.
Well, that's right, and there's a whole mystery about obelisks, why there are obelisks, really. I mean, mainstream Egyptologists are essentially saying, well, and I've done a lot of research into obelisks, and I've been to Egypt many times, and I've seen obelisks and going to the quarry, the unfinished obelisk, and I never get tired of going to Egypt. It's such a fantastic place with so many amazing structures and interesting things. And, of course, I had seen the obelisks many times in Luxor and other areas. But it finally, hit me on one of my trips to Egypt as I started researching obelisks that there's just something. I mean, it was like they were completely unexplained. And one of the things is that they're just gigantically huge for starters. They're when I say monolithic, they're giant, one piece granite crystal. An obelisk. That's why the name we call these things now, and it's a giant stone tower. Mainstream Egyptologists, according to them, the dynastic Egyptians, these pharaohs who had themselves put in the Valley of the Kings, like Tutankhamun or something, that they, for whatever reason, they worship the sun, and that the obelisk was a representation of a ray of sunlight. I mean, simply that. That if the sun reached out, the obelisk was this thing. So, and as I looked into it more, I realized that, wow, I mean, to make an obelisk, to erect it, to move it somewhere, to then stand it up, is a tremendous engineering feat, and perhaps the ancient Egyptians were capable of doing it. I've now concluded that obelisks are older than dynastic Egyptians and come from Atlantis. And as I've maintained in my books,
in my books too, I talk about that some of the survivors of Atlantis actually ended up in Egypt, and they had brought their talents with them, the talents of levitation and the way they could build these things.
Okay, that makes sense. Structures.
The only one I have seen, I've not been to Egypt yet, but is the one on the banks of the Thames, River in London. You've seen that one.
Yeah, sure.
Have the one that was brought from Egypt many years ago, and it's erected on the banks of the Thames as it goes through London. And they have the little sphinxes right next to it. But that one I don't think is as tall as the ones you're talking about.
That is a smaller obelisk. The biggest obelisks in Egypt have remained there because foreign governments couldn't move them. But one of the things that happened was, even during Roman times, obelisks were taken out of Egypt. They didn't really make new ones, but they took obelisks. And in fact, today, the city with the most obelisks is Rome. And, something like 12 or 15 obelisks there or something, and some are relatively small. So the Romans began this. I mean, the more you find out about obelisks, and there's very few books written about them. That was something else I found out, that kind of like the Olmecs, that there were very few books on the subject. People didn't have much to say. It was kind of a mystery. I mean, and that surprised me right there with obelisks, that there wasn't really a good explanation for even why the Egyptians or whoever was doing this, because it was a huge effort, and not for a good reason. I mean, you don't have this is one of the things with megalithic building and particularly with the ancients who, for some reason, like to build all these giant blocks of stone and stuff, is that you don't have to build things like that. Well, we don't today. We use concrete and plaster, smaller blocks of stone, bricks. Many of our structures are made of wood, and they won't last very long, in fact.
There won't be any evidence around in several thousand years that we even existed.
That's right. Well, I mean, if you look back at ancient Egyptian monuments and buildings, I mean, they were built to last for thousands of years, and they did last for thousands of years. They're sitting there right now for tourists to go and see. I mean, we don't really build buildings to last like that today. I mean, certain buildings in, say, Washington, D.C., the Lincoln Memorial, Jefferson Memorial, or something like that. I mean, and you want these buildings built out of really nice, giant pieces of marble and granite and stuff like that. Those things will probably last quite a while. Although things like the Statue of Liberty or like Golden Gate Bridge or something like that, especially things made out of metals, like in that way, those things will decay and they will rust and oxidize. If the Atlanteans had ever built some giant steel cable bridge over, across some bay or in something, it wouldn't be around today. It would be long, long gone.
In Europe, a lot of the cathedrals will be around. They've already been around for hundreds of years.
Well, they're going now about 1,000 years. That's right. And say like San Sofia Mosque in Istanbul. Yeah, that's 2,000 years. That's right. I mean, you need to build out of large blocks of stone. That is what will make things last a long time. Not out of bricks. Although many ancient buildings were built out of bricks, like in ancient Sumeria and ancient India and stuff like that. And we archaeologists have been able to excavate some of those structures, but they won't stand up so well as structures made out of giant blocks of stone. I mean, it's kind of interesting, the whole idea of what would survive from ancient times. And that's, you get into the whole myth of gold, actually. Gold is indestructible. All gold from ancient times still exists today. All gold jewelry, any gold coin that was ever paid to some legionnaire or whatever still is around. Gold is indestructible. But other metals aren't. Other metals and alloys, they will rust. They'll be gone. And gold is really too soft for, really making machines and things like that.
I was just thinking about what is that pillar that's made out of metal that has never rusted? You know which one I mean? I'm trying to think.
Yeah, I do, right. And, I've been there a couple of times. That's right in a suburb of New Delhi, in fact.
That's
made out of iron, and that's this famous pillar of iron that hasn't rusted. And it's a park now in New Delhi. Many tourists go there every day and see it. There's some other ruins around it. I've been there a number of times.
I was in New Delhi just this last year, and I didn't even think about it until after I'd left. I would have liked to have seen it. But I heard
that's a good
it.
One to see, yeah, right. And it is a display of ancient technology, of what ancient man can do. I mean, this is one of the problems that we're looking at from the mainstream archaeologists and that I'm, basically constantly battling in my books, is the whole idea of how we see the past and what it was like in ancient times. And they want us to see the past as like a direct graph from ancient man, caveman, just sort of straight line up to a modern man and all his cool inventions and everything. When, history is not like that. Yeah, history is this roller coaster of ups and downs. There's been dark ages and ages of science and mathematics and planned city.
The two of us know it's not like that. But, you know, in my books, too, I found out there were many, many civilizations that went down. It was not just Atlantis. There were others that reached very high peaks of civilization, and they were destroyed, and there's no evidence of them.
Well, right, and most would be underwater, and there wouldn't be much evidence. I think that's a fallacy of the mainstream archaeologists and the skeptics who, and it's very good to inquire and all that. I certainly do. I mean, you want to look into it. But, yeah, I mean, they naturally say, like, well, you know, if Atlantis existed or these other high-tech civilizations, well, you know, where's that Atlantean Mercedes, you know, out in the desert? Why don't we find that Vimana airship, you know, kind of there, you know, on a mountainside, having crashed there thousands of years ago or something? And they kind of, like, think, like, yeah, we should really find stuff like that. And we won't.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, that's what's wrong. No, that's not. You're not going to find that. And even if Vimana's head crashed on the mountainside, just like they're saying, it's just not going to be there a thousand years later. It simply won't. People, first of all, the first people who come along that Atlantean Mercedes in the desert, and, you know, I lived in Sudan back in the 70s doing oil exploration and drove a Land Rover through really remote areas of Central Africa and stuff, and deserts and swamps and stuff there. And I can tell you, I mean, if I was to leave my Land Rover there because it broke down and go back to the oil camp and come back a week later, that Land Rover wouldn't be there anymore. I mean, because somebody drove it away either. It wouldn't be there because people would have taken it apart, literally melted it down into spearheads and swords and things like that. I mean, I literally have seen it happen. And any kind of valuable metal like that, you have the same thing in South America and ultimately all over the world where these giant walls are fitted together. You have these clamps, keystone clamps, where these metal pieces are poured into these giant blocks. But you often see the marks in the stones for this, but you don't see the metal clamps very often. And that's because they've been long since taken by wandering tribes, other people who've just come into that area, you know, even hundreds of years later after some cataclysm or something.
It's the same thing in England with Stonehenge and Avebury especially. They know a lot of those stones were broken down and used over the many years, you know, in construction and things. So a lot of it is not the way it was in those days.
Well, right. And when you have things that are so old, and this is kind of a problem with thinking of civilizations like Atlantis and things that are over 10,000 years old, is that when you have 10,000 years, say, of civilization that's gone on since your city was destroyed or whatever happened, you abandoned some hilltop fortress or who knows. But in that 10,000 years, all kinds of stuff could have happened. I mean, people would have camped out there thousands of times, had big parties. Maybe somebody built their own little village in the middle of your ruins for a while and lived there for 200 years even, and then left.
Yeah.
And then archaeologists would later dig up that guy's, like, you know, ruined, broken dishes and other pottery and go, oh, well, this guy built Stonehenge. When, in fact, no, he just camped at Stonehenge for his family for 200 years. Okay, so, you know, it's that kind of a thing. But they're not often thinking that way, see? And as soon as they find that broken piece of pottery or something, bang, they think they've solved all the puzzles. But when it's only one of many clues,
I was on Art Bell's show, it's been a couple, several years ago, and I was talking about all kinds of things, and I got over 400 emails a day after that. One of them was from a female archaeologist, and she said, how dare you go on the air, I was talking about Atlantis, how dare you go on the air and talk about a civilization that there's not even one grain of truth that ever existed. And I kept thinking, you're an archaeologist. Where is your magic? Where's your sense of mystery?
Well, like, right. And well, and the oh, yeah, yeah. No, I am used to it. And you know, early on, what I will say to the skeptics, to the researcher or interviewers, is that, you know, it what it really comes down to is how old civilization is. That's simply basically it. And if you're a believer, say in Atlantis, you're believing that, as I do, that civilization, you know, isn't only, say, 8,000 years old. That would, you know, starting whatever 6,000 BC or something. If you believe that its civilization goes back, say 12,000 years to 10,000 BC, to 15,000 BC, well, and I believe all that. Well, then, you know, and archaeologists are more and more pushing civilization back to these dates. In fact. So, but, you know, you can call it whatever you want, but, you know, most people call it Atlantis. I mean, that is the name for a civilization that's that old. Ultimately, in the end, even the mainstream archaeologists, you know, and this may take some years, but it's steadily marching this way as new discoveries are found underwater, exactly what I'm talking about, this 300 feet underwater. I mean, that means all around India, around Indonesia, Southeast Asia, Thailand, Vietnam, all those areas, also in Europe and the Mediterranean, that you have these basically drowned kingdoms. And what we have left are just sort of the pyramids and cities that were built on the mountaintops and things like that.
Yeah. But, you know, it's one thing I want to ask you, too, about. I've heard that there was supposed to be stuff that was discovered in the Grand Canyon of civilizations that are, you know, along with, they even said even Egypt, the remnants of Egypt, and all of this is closed off to the public. They can't go into these areas of the Grand Canyon. Do you know anything about that?
Well, sure. And I write about that in my book on lost cities of North and Central America. Yeah, and that's one of the chapters. And that's one of my more popular lost cities books, which is a series of like 8 books. I'm working on a new book right now, Lost Cities, Ancient Mysteries of the Southwest, which also includes a whole new chapter all about that, the Egyptians and the Grand Canyon and the Southwest. Yeah, that all began, and the more research I've done on it, the more amazing it's gotten. But it all began in 1909 with a Phoenix Gazette article, which talked about the Smithsonian doing excavations in the Grand Canyon. They were finding these caves. Inside these caves were all these mummies. These mummies had artifacts, and they related them all to ancient Egypt, and also to ancient India. And so there were like Buddhas and like Krishna type statues and Shivas in there, other Egyptian type statues, artifacts, and they're very specific about that. They mentioned the name of an archaeologist who was to be doing the excavations. And then suddenly you didn't hear about this story anymore. And what was a front page story apparently got swallowed up by the government and the media of the day. And in fact, it became a little bit like the whole Raiders of the Lost Ark Indiana Jones movie, where at the end of that movie, yeah, Indiana Jones has discovered the Lost Ark of the Covenant, and well, they've got it back to Washington, D.C., and he says, well, what are you guys going to do with it? And they tell him, oh, you know, top men are going to be on it and handling it. And he's like, well, can I see it? And he's like, no, no, don't worry. Top Man will be looking at it. And then the last scene of the movie, and this is the very last scene of Raiders of the Lost Ark, where they're putting the Ark of the Covenant in this giant warehouse where all these other boxes are there too, and no one's ever going to see that thing. And
I've also heard that they've shut off that part of the Grand Canyon and they won't let tourists go into that area. Is that true? It's supposed to be down at one end that where the tourists don't usually go anyway, but it was supposed to be all closed off.
We don't really know exactly where in the Grand Canyon this was, really. They do talk, although in the article, they do talk about some creeks and rivers, although apparently names have changed. Much of the Grand Canyon is in an off-limit zone. All of the Grand Canyon is highly controlled. Parts of the Grand Canyon are Indian reservation. You cannot just go hiking into the Grand Canyon. Yeah, the more you find out about this, you find out early on that you can't really go into the Grand Canyon looking for some of these things, that's for sure. Even rangers are forbidden to go into areas of the Grand Canyon.
What you think something there they are afraid of, that they don't want people to explore?
Well, I mean, and that is for sure. That is for sure. And, part of it in their explanation can have to do with that they have sacred Indian things. For instance, one area of the Grand Canyon is where the Little Colorado Canyon, which is a whole separate canyon, similar to the Grand Canyon, goes into the Grand Canyon National Park and actually meets the Grand Canyon. And part of that is a Navajo Indian reservation. However, deep inside the canyon, and I'm more and more suspecting that it has something to do with the 1909 Phoenix Gazette article, that area is a sacred Hopi Indian area, even though it's a Navajo tribal reservation right around there. And we know that the Hopis had a salt mine in that area. And this is today an off-limits area. The more I've looked into that, I find that, you're not allowed to go into there.
Uh-huh. But then also, I heard that the Smithsonian has a lot of these artifacts, and they've hidden them away. They don't want people to see them.
That's right. And you know what? I mean, more and more of this stuff has been happening over the years, and it gets into national news even for a few months or something, and then then it's forgotten. For instance, around 1994, it was reported in all the major news magazines. I mean, this is archaeological fact that around Springerville, Arizona, which is near to the Zuni Indian Reservation, they found these caves. And in these caves were literally thousands of mummies in these caves that had been mummified. And It was in the news and things like that. There was, at the time, probably a few little Discovery Channel kind of things about it. They were saying that this totally changed their idea of American Indians because of the mummification whole bit, which was not really so known to American Indians and stuff. But here's the other part about it, that not one of those mummies has ever been on TV. Not one photograph. Not one tourist has ever gone into those caves and seen the thousands of mummies that are in those caves near Springerville. I've been there. And there's Springerville, the little town there, built a little museum, hoping for all these tourists to go there. And you can go into the museum, and it's all about this same site where thousands of mummies were found. And in that museum, there's no mummy in there. You will not even see a photograph of one. And, I mean, there's a couple of pieces of pottery. I mean, well, like in a couple of photos. I mean, there's hardly anything there. Perhaps a piece of cloth.
You didn't see anything either then when you went there.
No, well, you can, because they won't show it to you. On one hand, and they don't know who these people are, but, you know, but the idea is that, yeah, they're somebody's ancestors. And since they're somebody's ancestors, we can't be, it kind of shows you how politically correct archaeology is. Because these are somebody's ancestors, they can't show them to anybody. They can't put them on display. You can't even see a photograph of them. I mean, it's an archaeological cover-up, really, in a way. I mean, and it totally exists. It's utterly real. And it kind of fits into this Egyptian city in the Grand Canyon.
I would think it would be interesting to take X-rays or DNA samples or something. But they won't.
And you know what? Maybe they have, but we'll never know what the results are. I mean, they literally keep it all a secret. There is a... You know, there's a funny story that also goes along with this.
Well, one thing, David, before we get too far, I usually start out by asking people their background, but how did you get into all of this anyway? Go back to your beginnings and tell me how you got started.
Well, you know, I've always been interested in history and in science, also in paranormal things. I'm interested in travel. I was fortunate at a young age to travel around Europe and go to Stonehenge and Greece and Turkey. Also traveled in Mexico with my parents and things like that. And I was also a mountain guy who liked traveling, and camping and things like that. And eventually, I basically made it to the Far East. I was an English teacher in Taiwan. Later, I went to the Himalayas, and I had always been interested in Mount Everest and as well as Tibet and ancient Tibetan monasteries and mysteries and stuff. And, you know, as I started doing that, I worked overseas. And then in the end, I began writing the Lost Cities books. And my first book was a book, Lost Cities, Ancient Mysteries of African Arabia. Then I wrote a book on Lost Cities of China, Central Asia, and India. My popular book on Lost Cities and Ancient Mysteries of South America came out. And this was all in the 80s. So, you know, I was kind of one of the original vagabond travelers, backpacking, hitchhiking around the world, living on, you know, $3, $4, $5 a day kind of thing. And eventually, you know, I began writing these books, and I started my own publishing company in the end, which is called Adventures Unlimited. And, well, your listeners are welcome to go to our webpages, which is adventuresunlimitedpress.com, and you'll see my books and other people's books. We import books from all over the world, from Australia, South Africa, the UK, Holland. And we publish a number of books, too.
There wasn't any one incident then that started you off. You were just doing this all your childhood and your life, and so it was something natural. Is that what you mean?
Well, I guess so. Yeah. And it wasn't like, you know, I went anywhere specifically. I've traveled all over the world, in fact. And, you know, I mean, I maintain the more you travel and the more you see, the more you want to travel and then see more things. I'm sure you would agree with me. And it's kind of, you know, the more you learn and as you travel around the world, you learn a lot. And you realize, you know, how little you know, really. So.
Yeah, I feel sorry for the people that don't ever go anywhere. They think their little corner of the world is all there is. But there's a lot of mysteries out there. And it's to me, that's the exciting part. Going and
finding.
But But I know you do have, your publishing company is Adventures Unlimited, isn't it?
That's right. That's right.
That's your publishing company. And I know you did say it's not only your books, you have many other books that other authors do that you publish.
Yeah, we do. We publish Belgian authors, Ken Thomas. We do a number of conspiracy books, also books on underground, underwater bases, books on Tesla, UFOs, also books on Atlantis. We reprint old books, too. Books on Mongolia and Tibet, Central America and Peru. Usually, you know, things, books that are unusual have usually some kind of occult, supernatural element to them. And, you know, I'm personally interested in very much Atlantis, Mu, ancient civilizations, Vimanas, ancient India stuff like the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, even stuff like Mount Shasta and secret societies, books on the Templars we do a number of. We republish the Book of Enoch. I've done books on time travel, and a couple of our new books are out are also about suppressed technology, and some of that goes back to World War II and Tesla. That's a fantastic array of books and subjects, ones that, you know, I think books that your listeners would be pretty interested in.
Yes, and I was thinking that, can they find these in the bookstores, or should they go through your website, or what?
You know, either would be great. Hey, yes, we send a free catalog out. You can join our club and get our magazine, the World Explorers Club. That's also that's at wexclub.com. We have our catalog we send out, and our books are available in Borders bookstores. Other, go to your independent New Age bookstore wherever you live, and many of my popular books are Technology of the Gods, Lost Continents and the Hollow Earth. One of my new books is Pirates and the Lost Templar Fleet. We've been doing a bunch of books lately, too, about the end of the Mayan calendar and the 2012 coming up. So that's... I wonder what... What information do you have on that? Now I should be picking your brain.
I'm lecturing on all this stuff too. We're both of us into. I would say that I'm a reporter and a researcher of lost knowledge, and that's what you are too. You're doing the same thing. But one thing. Why don't you tell people about the Explorers Club? Now, can anybody just join that, or what?
Yeah. Our Explorers Club, anyone can join. Other Explorers Clubs often are very exclusive, and you have to be sponsored in by other members. Yeah, ours is not like that. Anyone can join. We have many foreign members. Our basic membership is $25 a year. You get a subscription to our magazine. We mail you stuff. We do expeditions and trips around the world every year. We have some conferences, and of course we inform you about all that. And we have other free gifts and things that we send people.
The people who are members of the club would be allowed to go on the expeditions that you're
on. That's right. Right. And you know, it's kind of the club that... What's that?
So you make all the arrangements and everything if the person does want to go on these archaeological
tours? Oh, okay. Well, you know, that would be like a travel agency. We're not really that, but we are a club and a networking organization for people who... And you'll see, in fact, we have a whole classified ad section where people are putting classifieds of their expeditions to lost pyramids or something like that. I mean, it's fun reading. And, you know, it's really sort of the magazine that Indiana Jones would read. It's the magazine, you know, and the club that adventurers like him, you know, would be reading, and the articles are all about that. In fact, in the new issue will be a big article about the Olmecs and all the strange statues and things they found and uncovered in the swamps and things like that. One of our new books is a book called Taos Gold by a guy named Stan Hall, and he's a Scottish explorer, a World Explorers Club member, and he's actually led a number of expeditions, including one with astronaut Neil Armstrong, going into these caves in Ecuador, trying to find these Atlantean gold tablets, these like Hall of Records kind of things, like Edgar Cayce talks about and others, these secret repositories of high-tech Atlantean artifacts or books, you know, engraved in gold, that kind of thing.
Well, wasn't there an Eric von Däniken book where he said he went down into some caves in Ecuador?
Exactly, yeah, that's right. And this book, it's called Taos Gold. It's one of our new books that is we've come out with the last couple of months. It's about, yes, Eric von Däniken going down into those caves, what Eric von Däniken claimed, who the people are, because it's an amazing story, and it's a mixture of fact and fiction. And it's all discussed in Stan Hall's book, Taos Gold, which you would see at our website, adventuresunlimitedpress.com. He goes there, and he talks about Eric von Däniken. He did not personally go there with von Däniken. He did stuff later, you see, because what happened there was von Däniken, among many other people, was informed about these caves, some of the artifacts that appeared in them. By the way, there's a story all about this in our next issue, in the last issue, actually, of World Explorer magazine. And they go into these caves. I mean, this is one of my books, too, touches on this subject, which was a book called Lost Continents and the Hollow Earth. And that was about the Shaver mystery, the whole idea of a Hollow Earth, holes at the poles even, strange things like that. But I also wrote a number of chapters in there about these ancient tunnel systems going deep into the earth. They're almost something out of, like, you know, Tolkien's Lord of the Rings or something, where you have these ancient mines and ancient tunnels going deep into the earth and through the mountains. I'm convinced...
Remember when I read that von Däniken book years ago, it said it was very dangerous to go into that area because of the natives. You know, they kill people because they were more or less protecting these caves.
Well, that's right. And, yeah, even today it's dangerous to go into those areas. And, in fact, that area is one of the famous Shrunken Head areas. So you're talking, and this is in the Amazon jungle areas of Ecuador, right where Ecuador and Peru and Brazil all meet. Those areas, too, while they're jungle, they're steep mountain streams and stuff. There's no roads in those areas. People travel by canoe and stuff up rivers. These Indian tribes are uncontacted. They're very territorial, naturally. And, I mean, it's part of their thing to actually kill people and turn them into shrunken heads and just hang them up on the roof rafter or something. So, I mean, that seems like a movie or something, but that it's still going on today. Things have not really changed in those areas at all. The government does try to keep these people from taking what they call trophy heads, which is the whole head-hunting culture they have, which is part of it. I mean, it's like being a man is killing somebody and making a shrunken head out of them. That's totally real.
Get over there, too. I'm watching the clock, David, and I'm going to have to stop because I don't, Don will pull the plug. We have to stop 5 minutes before. But I want to remind everybody, now this is David Hatcher Childress, and he can find you probably on your website, but also they can probably find you on Google anywhere, probably, can't they?
Yeah, sure.
You want to contact, how do you want them to go about it?
If people want to just call us up and either by phone get a free catalog or order some books with a credit card, they can call 1-815-253-6390, and you can dial that from any foreign country and even on weekends.
I give the number out again.
Yeah, that number is 1-815-253-6390. And
the website is Wex Club.
AdventuresUnlimitedPress.com. And then we have the World Explorers Club site, which is the magazine's World Explorer, and the website is WEX. We shorten it to WEX, WEXClub.com.
And the other one is...
And there's plenty of stuff there. Should excite your listeners, I think.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, there's a lot they can find. But I think they'll find some very exciting stuff if they contact you then. Okay, David, we're coming to the top of the time I have to sign off, but I want to thank you for being on the show. Because
it's
really
been great.
I respect what you do. I know I travel, but I wouldn't want to do what you do, and I really respect you for going out there and doing it. So thanks for being on tonight. Okay.
All right. It's been my pleasure.
Okay. Good night, everybody.